Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, Ramblers, and welcome to the latest Ramble Meets with me, Andy Brassel. Now, I know that for all of you listening, the current situation is challenges and we've all had to adapt. Of course, we're all recording and producing our shows for Football Ramble Daily at home at the minute. But if we're stuck inside, then so is everyone else. And I'd really wanted to get today's guest, Jan-Åge Fjørtoft, on for a long while. But as you might be aware, he now works in television and is seen on a variety of Champions League touchlines all over Europe. So I thought that the fact that all Norwegians who've been abroad were locked down even before the rest of the population might give me a chance to catch him, and so it proved. He was really generous with his time, and I'm sure you'll love it. It's not just a great journey from home via Austria to the Premier League and beyond, but as you'll discover, he's a really great storyteller too. So when we pick up the story with Jan, he's already started playing in his childhood home of Gersken, which is a small village in western Norway, in a mini stadium called River Plate, because it's around the time of the 1978 World Cup and the pitches next to the river, handily. And now his eyes have been drawn towards the bright lights of professional football down the road at Hood. What happens next? Let Jan tell you. This is Ramble Meets with Jan-Åge Fjørtoft.
So how did it come from you playing as someone who enjoyed the game locally to the point where you actually signed? Well, you turned pro with them at 17, didn't you? Is that right?
Well, what happened is that we were like, and a lot of other villagers, we were depending on our dads and uncles to be coaches and so on. And I remember when I was 14, we had my dad came to me, and he was in oil. He was a captain on a supply ship. And he said to me, I know we don't have got a good coach for you. So this year I'm going to be your coach. And I said, but dad, we have a problem. You're away half of the year. And he said, well, that's no problem. On the other shift, there is another guy. And he can do it. But he has never played football. He's never been a coach. So I always said that 5 years before I made my debut for the full Norwegian national team, I had Olav on the other shift as my coach. So it just shows you there are so many roads going all the way to the top, so to say. And for me, it was a natural step when I was 15 that I went to the biggest club in the region, the club called Hud, and they had a good proven record to develop young players. They did that in the 70s when they were up in the top flight, and even they had a guy called Åge Hareide, who is now the Danish national coach, and later then played for in the beginning of the 80s played for Manchester City and Norwich. So I kind of knew about that, and I remember when I was nine, that was the first time I met Åge Hareide. He was a schoolmate of my uncle, and that was a big day for a young Jan, and I'm happy and proud to say that Åge Hareide is now one of my best football friends.
And so after building your career in Norway at Hod and at Lillestrøm, you end up going to Rapid Vienna at 22. You have some great seasons there. And then by the time you're in your mid-20s, you end up going to England. And presumably this was always in your mind because, you know, I have Norwegian friends. I know how they are about English football. And I guess that was... English football was always a big part of your football upbringing?
Absolutely. And as you know, or maybe you know, but since 1969, we always had our match of the day that started Norwegian time, 4 o'clock, and your time, 3 then. And we always had one game, and every player, every person in my generation, and older and younger, they would all have their English favorite team. Mine was Leeds, because I was in 74-75. I discovered them when they played Bayern Munich in that famous European Cup final, when it was no offside, of course. I haven't seen it since 1975. So England was always on my mind. But at that time, we didn't have a great tradition in Norway to transfer players abroad. The big clubs or the big leagues or didn't look to Norway. We didn't have a lot of professionals. And at the time when I went from Lillestrøm to Rapid Vienna, the top record fee out of Norway was £70,000. And I was sold for £300,000. So that was a big step for us. And while I was in Vienna, we slowly get a better national team, which I think is a key for every country. If you see Belgium, Switzerland, Austria, all these kind of smaller football nations, you need to have a good national team to kind of be on the international stage. And slowly my mates like Erik Thorstvedt going to Tottenham and so on, that opened the doors for us others, because then they saw, well, it's at this time it's good to have Norwegians there, because they train well, they're more like us, they speak the language, and they are good guys, because we had some role models like Thorstvedt coming over. So that kind of opened the door for me being in Vienna. And I was also a bit lucky, because in those days we didn't have Bosman, so after a contract was up, you were kind of you just had to wait what the club would do. Is it was not in your hands, there was no power, they could kind of block everything. So after 4 years, I thought 4 years is enough. I after the first year I was very close to going to QPR together with a teammate of mine, Andreas Herzog, but Trevor Francis got sacked, and he watched a lot of our games. I met Trevor Francis in Vienna, so we were very close to going there. But after 4 years I knew this was enough. I was 26. I had to make another step. So I kind of orchestrated my going away, because I had to go away. And then I was lucky and good enough. Like in those days, you had to do videos of your highlights, very bad quality, but you sent them around. You sent them around in big white envelopes. And I sent it to all the agents I knew and some football people. And one of them was David Hay. And David Hay, being a Celtic legend, being a Chelsea player at this time, he was my manager in Lillestrøm. So I sent him a tape. He saw my goals, and then after a while, in these days you're not happy if someone doesn't reply after 1 hour. This is like if you reply after 2 weeks, we were happy. And I was at my grandparents' house in Norway, and I remember they said, there is this guy who wants to get hold of you, you have to give him a call. And that was David Hay. And David Hay said that Glenn Hoddle had left Swindon, and their assistant manager, John Gorman, was about to be the next manager. And he was, David Hay, supposedly be the assistant manager. And he said, if I get that job, we are very eager to get you to England.
But by this time, you'd already kind of announced yourself to the English public a little bit before that. Because, of course, the summer of 1993 was the summer of, well, for us, the infamous Norway 2, England 0 in the World Cup qualifier, which you played a big part in. So how were you greeted when you got to England, having been part of that?
Well, I was greeted by the Scottish players, very welcome. they kind of loved me, but it's true. It is true. At the same time that I played in Vienna, I had a chance to play for our national team, and we got Egil Olsen as a coach, and we did very well. We went into a qualification group with San Marino was the weakest team, of course, but then we have Turkey, Holland, Poland and England, and it was an enormous group for a small Norwegian team, and we ending up winning the group, we ending up scoring the most goals in that group. So yeah, so I guess we made a name of ourselves, and I think that it was also indirect consequence of us doing well, as I said in the beginning, that the national team did well, because then we showed that we can do it on an international stage, and there was a big chance that we will do it in better leagues. And a lot of these players that played for Norway at that time was in England or ended up playing in England. So I guess that you can say that the national team helped us take the next step. And I think also that there were so many Norwegians. We were at the time, we were like between around 25 players who played in the Premier League, and that also helped the national team, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. It was a real golden age, wasn't it, for Norwegians in the Premier League in those first couple of years of the Premier League. I used to love Øyvind Leonardsen. Of course, you set up that first goal for him against England in 93. I mean, when you look back at that era now, does it make you feel sad that there aren't quite as many Norwegians in the Premier League, or is that just a fact of life that you live with?
Well, first of all, I see now in Norway, we were supposed tomorrow to play the Nation League semi-final against Serbia, obviously cancelled. But first of all, I and then people say, well, we haven't been at a championship since 2000. And that is 20 years. Well, when we qualified in 93 for the 94 World Cup, we hadn't been in a championship since 1938. So at the time that we succeeded doing that, when I look back now, it's more of a proudness because I see that at that time, Norway, we loved our skiers and we did well in different sports. But to do well in football, that made a small country like Norway very, very proud. And I think that to be a part of that kind of mission of identity, a positive nationalism, I'm very proud to be a part of that. And a lot of those players, I don't think we knew at that time that we were potentially quite good leaders. But sometimes small nations, they depending on good generations. I guess big countries do as well. We know the golden generation of England, which didn't do as good as they could have. And we also saw that in Germany with Schweinsteiger and Lahm, who also used a bit time before they won the Champions League in 13 and the World Cup in 14. But still, we are depending on it because we can't lose any generation. And there was a bit also a bit timing because I came to England in year two of Premier League and that was before everything exploded, that any foreign player would end up in England because of the money, because of the quality and so on and so on. So I always tell the story about me being at Sky talking about how it is like to be a foreigner in English football. And now the fact is that you have English people talking about how it is to be an Englishman in English football. And so things changed. So it was a good timing. We had an agent who was good in the English market, a guy called Rune Haugo, as everybody knew at the time, took a lot of players over. We had a national coach who had a great philosophy. He was a bit ahead of his time because we were very good defensively, but also the way we attacked with like unbelievable speed. And till the other teams kind of realized that not only the passing that some clubs and national teams at that time thought was the key to everything, we kind of rushed in goal after goal. And if you have a look at the second goal that we scored against England at home, it was like back, our goalkeeper was forward and back and up to me, back to one player, putting it in, and it's 1-0, 2-0 against England. And so I think that we kind of shocked the way we played. We shocked them, and we managed to do that for 3-4 years.
And when you did make it to the Premier League, it was a sort of slow start for you, but a real season of two halves at Swindon, because you couldn't get it going at all before Christmas. And then all of a sudden, with this goal you score against Tottenham, you're off and away, and all of a sudden you're scoring goals for fun, and there's even a possibility that Swindon could stay up for a little bit.
Well, what happened is that when I came to England, like you said, I felt it was a dream come true. I still get that goosebumps when I think of me flying into Heathrow, knowing that I'm going to play in the English Premier League, that I'm going to play in England, and be able to play against the best teams, teams that I follow since I was born. And the first game we played at Bramall Lane, and we played a 1-1. I got a knock. I think we got a 1-1. I think it was. And I got a knock on my foot. I got a small injury, or a small. It was an injury that kind of didn't help me. But did I tell the manager? Did I tell the physio? Of course I didn't, because I wanted to play on. And I thought that I was not used to being injured anyway. And I thought, for a goal getter, if you're in there, you're lucky to get that goal. And so slowly, over the autumns, getting more and more games, I didn't play well. I didn't break the code to English football. And what is happening then is that you kind of lose your confidence. So people saying that the manager will lose confidence in you, well, that you can get back. I mean, that you can somehow get back. But the worst thing is to kind of lose your confidence in yourself. So it's funny enough, at the same time we are qualifying for the World Cup, funny enough, I score a deciding goal in Poland that gets us to the World Cup. So it was kind of two worlds for me. And when I came back, but slowly, when you lose your confidence, you think, do I have to do something else? Do I have to play another way? Well, is my quality, well, the quality is enough maybe for Austrian football and the philosophy of the national team? And then you kind of get into a terrible circle. And Christmas Eve 1993 is a down point in my career. I'm playing for Swindon B team, again a reserve team, against Wickham reserves in a place outside Swindon that they were so windy that our explorer, the Norwegian explorers, wouldn't have survived it in the North Pole and the South Pole. And I had three jackets under my shirt. I was the worst man on the pitch, and I came home in my house, and my parents were there. My brother and sisters came from England to celebrate Christmas. And I opened the door. It was like 5 o'clock at Christmas Eve. And I said, just have a look at my face. A, it's still frozen. And B, it's not possible to go lower in a football career than I am now, because I'm gone. And then we had a great Christmas, and I was on the bench getting some minutes. And then my son was born the 12th of January. And I have signed a new a loan contract in Lillestrøm going home, because I wanted to save my place in the squad for the World Cup. I mean, I couldn't miss that as a Norwegian. But then we played a FA Cup game away at Ipswich. And one of our strikers, I think it was Keith Scott, he was cup-tied, and I got the chance. And still the same story, hitting the post, doing the right decisions. But then I got my first goal in England, and then against a Tottenham at home, as you said, in a 1-1 game, I scored the 1-0 goal. A funny story there is that Erik Thorstvedt who was one of my roommates in the national team, he was stretched off after, like, in my head, I'm not sure if exact the time, but like 16-17 minutes. So he stretched off, that big lad, and that's a great friend of mine, and I went over to him and I said, you are can we swear on this podcast? No, we can't. Yeah, okay. I said to him, well, you fucking coward, you're going off now, and I'm about to score my first goal in the Premier League. And Ian Walker came on, and like 5-6 minutes later, I made my first goal in the Premier League. And then I couldn't stop scoring. And I think at that time, and someone reminded me the other day, I think from January then and out, I think it was only Letizia who scored more goals than me in the whole Premier League. So it was basically that we had a team that conceded goals for fun, but we went forward. We loved to go forward. We played with a guy called Nicky Summerby, if you remember him, the son of his dad. It was a fantastic crosser of the ball. But unfortunately, we conceded too many goals. goals. We were a bit naive. We were a newly promoted team, and we had a manager, John Gorman, the nicest man in football, who still wanted us to pass the ball and be positive going forward. And at the end of the season, we had conceded 100 and we scored 6 goals less than Arsenal, who were 4th or 5th in the Premiership. So it was a unbelievable rollercoaster season for me.
But when you bear in mind that start and the low point you were talking about against Wickham Reserves, how does it make you feel if you've been back to the County Ground since and seeing that mural of yourself on the wall doing the aeroplane celebration? You know, it shows that, like, when Swindon fans talk about their best ever players, they really talk about you and Don Rogers, don't they, who scored the goals in the League Cup final against Arsenal in the late 60s?
Yeah, well, I think that, first of all, very honoured to do that. And sometimes, a couple of times when I played for some clubs and I bring them back, and I'm always get it, always a good welcome. And my son always said when he was a kid, "Why don't you do this often?" And I said, "Yeah, I could done that, but I'm more that a kind, always look forward." But it makes me happy and be proud. But on the other hand, I could have loved to played for the big teams like Liverpool and Manchester United or Chelsea and whatever. But different things, lack of quality maybe, didn't take me to the next step. But when I see back on, especially my time in England, is that I was fortunate to play at Swindon, at Middlesbrough, at Barnsley, especially Sheffield United was a bit different, although we had a very hopeful team there that lost the playoff final, and then two players, Brian Dean and myself, were sold on the same day and kind of crushed that team. But I was at the time in Swindon and Barnsley and Middlesbrough where there was an enormous optimism around the city, and not only at the football team, there was that proudness, that identity, that kind of thing that for the first time ever, they had a chance to play against the big teams. You can imagine Barnsley going to Anfield and winning. You can imagine Swindon play Manchester United at home, and we had a 2-2 draw with Schmeichel and that golden generation slowly coming with Eric Cantona stabbing John Moncur. I mean, this proudness, yeah, and this proudness, the kind of these areas, these regions had, was unbelievable. And I think that maybe as I was the goal scorer, as I was a guy that had my airplane celebration, that I basically often am in good mood, I think that then I'm maybe fortunate to be one of the symbols for that great period of time.
And there's this story before you go to Middlesbrough, which is sort of on the home straight of their promotion running, so it would have been like your second season at Swindon, wouldn't it,
yeah,
after relegation, that you end up joining one of the promotion chases in Middlesbrough. I've got to ask you, there's this story that you don't know what's going on with any potential transfer, so you ring up Ricky Hunt, the chairman, pretending to be a journalist. Is this right?
It's right, but I'm not sure. I don't think it was Ricky Hunt. I think there was that guy with the beard. What was his name? I can't remember his name, because there were kind of two chairmen, and Ricky Hunt coming then from the oil company Burma, I think. Yeah. So, but anyway, there was the chairman, a beardy guy, and I was sitting at the back of the bus, and at that time there were not many people who had a mobile phone, but he was one of them, and I was one or two players who had it. So I had his number and I called him. That's true. And I'm sitting in the back seat, and I'm saying that I'm a Norwegian journalist and I just want to interview you about Jan Fjørtoft. And he said, yeah, good lad, and blah 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 blah, scoring a lot of goals. Yeah, but we're just wondering about his future. Yeah, we'll probably let him go, but it's all about the offers we're getting in at the moment. It's not happening a lot. And I said, thank you very much, and say hello to Jan. So that is 100% true story.
So you end up at Middlesbrough, as you say, an extraordinary time for Middlesbrough as well, because I mean, you played the end of that season at Ayresom Park, didn't you, before they moved to the Riverside at the start of the next season when they got promoted. I mean, after that, Middlesbrough really start to get momentum. In 95-96, you have this great start to the season before if you fall out of the European places at the end. But of course, there's this great click between you and Juninho.
Yeah, exactly. And what I thought after Swindon, I thought that the Premiership club would come in for me. I kind of hope that someone will get in, because this season I ended up scoring 28 goals in all competitions, but that never happened. And then Brian Robson called, and you know how he's like. I mean, that's what Kenny Dalglish always did at Blackburn. I mean, when Brian Robson call you, you kind of say yes before you come to Robson, because you want to be a part of that aura of that great player. They sold me a project. They sold me Riverside Stadium. As you said, I played the last games that season. I played at Ayresome Park. I was fortunate to score they called it a Buzz Aldrin goal at the Riverside, because Craig Hignett scored the first and I scored a second. But I had a big chance that I missed in the last game at Ayresome Park, and I always think, I should have had the last game at Ayresome, the first in Riverside. But it was unbelievable exciting times. And when I came there for £1.3 million, who then was the record signing. And then we got Nicky Barmby, and I think he came for like five, so we kind of four times the amount that they gave for me. And so things were going very quickly. And it was funny enough that Nicky Barmby, Craig Hignett and myself, we had a good formation and got a very good understanding playing up front. Then Juninho came, who was the best player I've ever played with, an unbelievable player. And I was fortunate enough to make his debut very good. I always say that. I make it the other way around, because Juninho came... and he was a great, great lad. I always say he's a magician, the Harry Potter of football. And he put me through against Leeds United. And remember, that was my favourite team when I was a kid. And I chipped Lukic, and it was a great, great goal. And so he came, and Juninho came, and he was the start. And then we got Ravanelli in, just been winning the Champions League. We got Mikkel Beck, who was a Danish young talent, who coming in. And then I have to say, as Lady Diana, it was a bit crowded up front, because we just played with one striker. And so in that season, I got less and less chance. And I felt it was time to move again.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This episode of the Football Ramble is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life throws many different challenges at us, and as a result, we all have our own sources of stress. Whether big or small, those stresses can impact our lives in unpredictable ways, and if we don't address them, they can have an outsized and unwanted impact. Therapy is a safe place in which we can address these issues, learn to understand them, and find ways to work through them. Having therapy can be beneficial to anybody, not just people who've experienced major traumas, even if you may have not considered it before. It could be simply a time for you to get things off your chest, a way to learn positive coping skills, or how to set boundaries. Ultimately, it can be whatever you need it to be. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire, and BetterHelp will match you to a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
We could call it Pete and Mark's Colossal Tassel.
But we didn't. We called it Wrestle Me. Wrestle Me, Mark.
Wrestle Me, Peter.
A celebration of all things WrestleMania and beyond. And you may be thinking, I'm not really into wrestling. Well, don't worry. There's something for everyone. To be honest, it's mainly about stuff like this.
So hang on. Easy Lover was the original theme on WrestleMania.
And, it was. And... someone heard it on the radio and went, that sums up everything about WrestleMania to me.
And this. You can really see the old back acne on test.
Yeah.
And this.
Is it worth reminding people of what Earthquake John Tenta looked like at 23 years old?
Yeah, I think so.
And this.
For the record, Marty has made it very clear, and I agree and believe him, that he has never, A, had sex with his daughter, or B, wanted to have sex with his daughter.
And the people behind the face paint doing the most unique job in the entire world. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. That's Wrestle Me.
Wrestle Me, Mark.
Wrestle Me, Pete.
When it got to the back end of your spell at Barnsley, when did you know it was time to leave England? Was it because of the offer from Eintracht Frankfurt, or had you just had enough anyway? How did that work?
No, I think it was often transfers are more coincidentally as you may think, because Sheffield United, they sold me and Dean on what the Sheffield United fans call the Black Thursday. It was just like we were both, the strikers were gone, probably some bills to pay, you never know. Then I went to Barnsley, and the reason I went to Barnsley is that I had a chance to play in the Premiership again, but we got relegated, and John Henry, my teammate, and now my roommate, was the manager. The first thing he does is tell me to call him Gaffer. So I can't call you Gaffer. So from day one, it was hard for me to kind of play with. He was still a striker. He did a wrong way. I think he should have played other strikers, but he put himself in the team. And John, I love John Henry. He's a great, great lad, but he's not the best manager I've had. And I've had some bad. And so there was a bit thinking of me going back to Sheffield United, that I had a great spell and I still lived in Sheffield. I saw the players all the time. But one of my teammates in the Norwegian national team, he always called me and said, Jan, I'm playing Eintracht Frankfurt. We need a striker. Why don't you come here? And I was like, I just got another kid. We had two kids. I bought my house in Sheffield, and I said, "It's a too big step." And I loved I love England. I always loved England. I still do, and I wanted to live there. And then two games on the bench again, and then he calls me again. He's an agent now, and I always say that I'm his first signing, and he always says that. And he was a player, and then at one time I thought, well, German Bundesliga, I want to play football. I am on the bench in the championship. There is no future. I was more or less finished with a national team anyway, but still, I had a hunger and passion to do well on a pitch. I love scoring goals. I love to play. And I'd also been a big admirer of German football. England and Germany were always the two teams or two countries that I followed. And I followed Bayern Munich and all that. So I had a chance to go there. So I went down to Frankfurt and had a look. We negotiated a contract and I signed. And I came to the hotel and... the telephone calls, and I have a look, and I see this the gaffer that called me, and I just took in the hotel room. I started with a rant on him for 1.5 minutes, calling him all names in a book of swearing words. And when I was finished, John Henry said, "You have signed, have you?" and from then on, we were teammates again, we were roommates again, and we were laughing. And yeah, so then I suddenly was in Germany with two kids in Sheffield, and I made a deal with them that the two first months, I think this was in November-ish, November, December, October, whatever. So I was commuting, so we played on a Saturday. I went home with the plane to Manchester, then a car to Sheffield, and then I went home again or back to Germany Monday night. So it was a quite stressful time, but it was fantastic to play in Germany, and started a new love affair for me that I still kind of use now, because I'm a lot in Germany. And I was going from being on a bench for Barnsley in the championship to play for 65,000 in Dortmund. That was my first game on a Friday night, playing Julio Cesar and Sork and all that great Dortmund team. So that was fantastic.
Well, it's clear even when you talk about Eintracht now, Jan, that they're a huge part of your footballing life. What is it about Frankfurt as a club that makes them so special?
Well, first of all, it's the only club in Germany. So I would love to have the same to one club in England, but I can't do that because I got four clubs. There is a lot of women I would like, but I'm married. Let's put it this way. So that is a good start, I think. But Eintracht was special in the again, I'm always one of those, and I've been that all my life. I always try to put my own career and sport and football and fans in a wider perspective, and there are things happening in a football life that is just meant to be unbelievable. We had at the end of the 98-99 season, my first season there, scored very early, but we still had a bad spell and we were fighting against relegation. There is four games to go. We are playing Werder Bremen away, Dortmund at home, Schalke away, and Kaiserslautern, who wanted to get into Champions League with Otto Rehhagel, Ballack, and a fantastic great team. And we won all games, and we won, and I guess except the game against Werder Bremen, I scored in all three or four games. And then it's a special game at the end where before the last round of the German season, the papers, as they do, there were like so many teams that could go down, and they made kind of all kind of, as you do at the end, if this happened, and then they had a session of thing that will probably not happen, and then they had a section of what could happen but will never happen. But the thing is, what happened was even not on that list. So we are ending up leading 4-1 at home. It's in the 90th minute, and this is before live updated tables, and it's quiet in the stadium, 60,000 people, and then there is one of our reserves who start kind of counting out the table, and he sees a thing that we never have thought of. If we scored another goal, we would have the same goal difference of like Nürnberg, who was never ever going to go down, because, and they had even planned and was everything ready for a barbecue and beer to stay up party. So at 4-1 in the 90th minute, they kind of shouted in, if we score another goal, we'll be all right. And like I said in German TV afterwards, well, I just had to score one then. And I scored a goal around the 90th minute, and I did it with a trick that I kind of did when I was a kid. They call it in German Übersteiger. That is a trick that I kind of do a different trip. Yeah, step over, and I get the goalkeeper down, and then I score with the other foot. And this goal saved our place in the Bundesliga, and I kind of, that connected, I guess that goal connected me to Frankfurt for the rest of my life. And there are always in the end of the seasons, they call me up as the expert on big relegation dramas, and I guess that's one of the reasons that I do a lot of work in Germany. I'm a bit like Jerry Armstrong, Armstrong that scored for Northern Ireland in Spain, and he's still an expert for Spanish football, like the World Cup was in 1982. So I guess I'm the new Armstrong.
But that goal is such an iconic one, isn't it, against Kaiserslautern? I mean, I think it was Ballack's last game for Kaiserslautern, and you can see him trying to get back as you put the finish away.
Yeah,
it's such a calm finish when you know how much is riding on it.
And I know, and I always say that if I miss that one trying to do that, I will probably never be in Germany again. And I mean that is timing in football again. Having said that, I always did that when I went straight to the goalkeeper, because there was so much when you go straight at the goalkeeper at that, there is not much angle. So either you have to chip it early, or you have to use your speed that I never had to pass the goalkeeper. So that this was what I did. And yeah, I'm very proud. They had a Bundesliga had a big thing now of 50 things in their 50th history of the Bundesliga, and Bundesliga is a great league, and this was nominated as one of them. And yeah, this goal is unbelievable. And I always say that if every Frankfurt Frankfurter who come up to me and say they were in the stadium, this would be like 200,000 capacity stadium because everybody was there. And there was also an iconic radio commentators, because they had this, as you have in England, they go from pitch to pitch, and this is guy from Frankfurt. He's fantastic. He says, Yanis, and then he does this, and what about this? It's like a dog's nose. He's so cold in that position. And then this guy from Nuremberg comes in, and we are slowly dying in Nuremberg. And when I came home, it was unbelievable afterwards. When I came home to my house in Frankfurt, all the neighbors that I didn't know a lot, but they still, the whole house were into Frankfurter colors. And then I came into my family, and we were sitting down and watching the highlights before we went to a party. And then Frank Baumann, who is now the sport director of Werder Bremen, he missed the biggest ever chance. So if he scored that not even that 5-1 would be enough. And I remember I got nearly sick. I had to sit down on my sofa because I was unbelievable. And last year in October, I met Frank Baumann again. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. And he was now the manager of Werder Bremen. And I didn't say anything, and he didn't say anything. And then he just looked at me and he said, "Are we going to talk about that day in 1999? And I said, "Well, you had to start." And it was that is the great thing about football, I guess.
So you wound up your playing career in Norway and retired at 35, and then you become the sporting director at Lillestrøm. You're there for 4.5 years.
The
team won the cup in that time,
which
I think was either the last or the penultimate time that they won the Norwegian Cup. So how do you get from working very much day to day at a club to the point where you think, actually, I think my future is in broadcasting instead?
Well, I will do the opposite round, because when I went to Vienna when I was 22, I was always very curious about life in general. I mean, if I will do a quiz, I will do it on politics instead of football. I've always been interested in society, how society works. And when I came to Vienna, I saw this synergy between... Is synergy as an English word? So between politics, commercial, sport, and culture, and I met all these kind of people in small, tight Vienna. When you play for Rapid Vienna, was the people's club, so to say. But I saw also that all of them, all the prime ministers and all the CEOs, what they all wanted to do was to be me. They wanted to play for Rapid Vienna, and in terms of that's what were their dreams. So I thought that. I've always, since I was a kid, and I got that confirmed when I was in Vienna, that sport is very, very important. And that gave me confidence. So when I was finishing my career, I thought, I always was curious, and I always followed CEOs, I always followed politicians. You have a chance as a footballer to get to know a lot of people. And I was always curious. I was always meeting people, learning from different people in different angles. So, but when I'm ending in my career, I was not like everybody else sure of what was I good at, what was I doing well, and then I slowly had to kind of define what a former sportsman is good at, and a lot of people are struggling of that, and I'll see surveys saying that, especially in England and Germany, a lot of the players, like 75%, are bankrupt and I don't know what to do. And I didn't never want to go that way. So I wanted to widen my perspective. So when I was finished with my football career, I knew that I had to go into TV. I have to go do sports. So I did that for our BBC in Norway. I was the first time they had a pundit in Norway. Then they had been over to Sky, and Sky had spoken very highly of me because I worked for Sky in England. And they said, well, you have to go on Jan, and that was a good chance for me to start. But I also saw that I wanted to do a lot of thing more. So I made my communication company, slowly starting with working with commercial companies. And also, but I also had a respect for me being a former footballer. So I did my whole coaching badge, but I didn't do my coaching badge to be a coach. I just wanted to get a system of everything that I have learned over the years, because I knew that that would do well for me in my other careers. And then the sporting director thing, I didn't want to be a sporting director. I've turned on Rapid Vienna twice. I've turned on clubs in Norway. I didn't want to be a sport director, but Lillestrøm was my club. So Lillestrøm came in and said, Jan, we have new owners. It's not allowed to have owners in Norway because we have this 50 plus one kind of rule that the member's going to own thing. But this was the guy who paid all bills. And he said, Jan, I want you to be my right hand. So, and because it was Lillestrøm, I had been there two spells, actually. I won the league there in 89. And I loved the club since I was a kid when my favorite player was called Tom Lund, who was a famous Norwegian player. So there, and he was a part of that consortium, of course, help me, with the consortium, the guys who invest.
Consortium.
Exactly. and so he was a part of that. So I wanted to come back to Lillestrøm. And I did that for 4.5 years. But I said, I must still be able to work for TV. So I hosted our Champions League show. And I also slowly building up my communication company. So I've been fortunate to, after my career, to do a lot of different stuff. So now I share a lot of my life is to be an advisor to CEOs in politics and in commercials. But still being able to do the pitch side interviews and do the football pundit kind of role that maybe is one third of what I do. And then people ask me, so you're not so much into football. And I always said, yeah, everything I do is football, because I do the metaphors all the time. I talk about when I work with CEOs, it's about team, it's about timing, it's about be able to be in the right position to the right time, and when to wait, when to be. And I remember Hans Krankel always said to me, Jan, when you come into the box, and he was a famous goleador who was my coach at the Rapid Vienna, and he said to me, it's always better to be a bit late, because then you can always adjust. If you're too early, you can't adjust, and things like that. And kind of, you can metaphors you can use also in commercial, do the analyze, what's the best thing that can happen, put yourself in that position. So somehow I'm still a footballer, and at the time when I am in Norway, as everybody else now in isolation, I'm going all through my old stuff, and I see that I have a good connection to football when I start cleaning up in my home office.
So with Viasat and with Sky Deutschland, you've done it all, really. You've been the anchor, you've done punditry, you've done that touchline interviewer thing, and we always see you with the coaches after the big Champions League games and all the rest of it. What's your preference, or do you like to mix all of them?
Well, I started as a normal pundit, and I was able in Norway to kind of define that role on my own for like the Norwegian BBC, which had enormous viewing numbers. And then I had a chance, and I was the host of Viasat for 8-9 years. And after 8-9 years, we needed to reshuffle. I had a very good connection to my CEO, and I said, maybe I will say that before you tell me that. And then we got another a woman in who came on, and I did for 1.5 seasons a pundit, but that kind of bored me, just to be a pundit again. So I wanted to go more out to perform, and then I started as a pitch side reporter, and I haven't seen back since that. I love doing that. I am as close as I can, and I have to, in every round I'm away, I have to fight in a higher weight class, because we are a small company. We are just Scandinavia, and I have to compete with Sky of Sky Germany, Sky England, and BT Sport, and ZDF, and ARD. So I have to find my own style, you have to build up your credibility. You have to build up your ability to get them to talk to you. And I guess it's a advantage for me in terms of that I played the game myself, but the coaches, most of them, well, Klopp, that I've known for many, many years, he will know that, but most of course coach won't know that. But I think that they will know it when they hear my questions, because I'm not so much into this formation in midfield. I don't care about that. I'm more into what did you do to get that player going again after you told him that he was not good enough for your team, and those kind of things. And yeah, so I love doing that. It's a bit stressful then and again, but that's life. And now when I'm sitting here in isolation, I guess we all miss that stressful time, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. Well, as well as TV, of course, you're also the father of a footballer now, because Marcus is playing in Scotland. How are you as a footballer's father? Are you tense? Do you take a step back and let him get on with it? How are you with it?
Well, you should ask him, but I'm seeing me from outside. I am, first of all, not one of those parents who have to live their dreams through to their kids. I'm not that at all. I am unbelievably nervous and tense, unbelievable. But I'm also very proud. I'm very proud of Marcus, because Marcus is an example. Sometimes when we see the great stories of football players, we tend to forget that this is 0.05% of all players who play football. And Marcus went another way. He went, when he was 18, he went to America, went to Duke, got a scholarship there. He got a master's of one of the greatest prestigious universities in USA, played football. I was still nervous with a one camera thing, middle of the night. I was watching every game and I was so nervous I couldn't sleep. So I'm the worst father in terms of tensity and nervosity. But then after, when he was like 23 or something, then he said, then I was nearly that old fashioned father, wanted to tell Marcus, maybe it's no time that you use your master's in economy. There's not a lot of footballers that have that. And I said, maybe now it's time to get a proper job. But before he said that, he said, Dad, I would just want to tell you that I want now to travel the world playing football. And I said, okay. And so he went to New Zealand, played 1 year in New Zealand. It's not possible to get further away from your parents. I mean, we should maybe take that as a sign. And then he sorted out that he had a trial in Scotland. And the good thing about everything is that I haven't been involved. Obviously, I talk to my kids more or less every day, and I help him. I put up his safety net and try to give him some advice that he can follow or not follow. But he went to Scotland all on his own, and he made a trial, and they offered him a contract. I know they offered him to extend that contract. And Marcus is now 26, but as a footballer, he's like 22-ish, because he'd never played professional football before he came to Scotland as a 25-year-old. And we took the family over and we saw him play against Rangers for 50,000. And yeah, I'm unbelievable proud. And he's playing a centre half, a big, big centre half. So he's a different player than me, but still, I'm so proud that he goes his own way, and I try not to interfere at all. And when, for example, he did his contract, he had a help from a good agent in Scotland. I didn't even look at the contract. So after 1 month, I said, "Can I have a look at your contract?" And he said he sent it over. And yeah, so I tried to let him have his own life, but I talk to him every day because I think he will do mistakes, and he doesn't have to do all the same mistakes that I have done. But I think is so good. And I mean he's not on a great money in Scotland, but he went from being a student to be a professional. So I said to him, you will never have more money in your life feeling than you have now. And he has the right ideals. And I sometimes think, and he got a friend there as well playing who did the same at Duke, and I sometimes think, and I hope that they should get more press for the way they've done it, because I think that could be a way for a lot of players who can do that, because everybody won't get it to the Premier League or the Championship even, but then go and do your education, and then you have two legs to stand on. And I think the agent was quite good. He told me that the chairman said when he extended his contract, and they said, yeah, but when will you come again for another contract? And he said, one thing I can tell you about Marcus, he's the only one who's losing money playing here, playing football. And I think that is a good legacy of his football career, because he's just following his passion to be as good as he can.
and arriving in the UK at 26, could there be a better sign? Surely not.
No, I don't think so. And I think that there will be ups and downs. And there are some games that he... And I always said to Marcus when they lost, then you just have to... Then he will be out. And then we got another guy in. And I think just have to put your perspective where you are in life. And then he came on and he played three games. And one of them, he played very well. I saw that game. And then he lost again. He will be out again. But that is a part of football. I mean, a manager will always make decisions. And then you just have to build up your credit. And that's why I think that sometimes footballers should have another perspective, because there is no use of being annoyed at the manager, because the manager's decisions anyway, and you just have to do as good as you can and prepare as good as you can, and then whatever happened, I think what he will learn from his dad is that I tried to get football into perspective, and I still use what I learned in football in other capacities. And like Marcus, he got the education as well, so he will soon overwhelm me. So I'll try to get him to be in football as long as I can, so he won't be bigger than me.
This was a Stakhanov production.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.